Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk about the founding of the League of Nations. And I think this is probably going to take us over quite a few podcasts, as it is one of the products of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. The League of Nations was one of Woodrow Wilson's projects at the Paris Peace Conference. But it wasn't the first time that an international organisation, not only to manage world affairs, but to outlaw war had been mooted. For example, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the Russian Tsar Alexander I saw a kind of a unity of Christendom, of Orthodox, Catholic and Protestant countries uniting against the despotism and barbarism of revolutionary forces that had been unleashed by Napoleon, in his view, obviously, and thought that there could be some almost slightly mystical union of nations and sort of a concert of nations. More realistically, I mean, the likes of Lord Castlereagh and Prince Metternich rather scoffed at this when they heard it. But more realistically, in the 19th century, various attempts from the Vienna Congress through to the Bismarckian system to create a kind of a concert of Europe and to create a system of regulating world affairs, preventing wars between great powers and deciding upon the distribution of empires and colonies. This, in Wilson's eyes, was not a stable system, not a system that led to world peace, but inevitably, due to secret treaties and rivalries, particularly imperial rivalries, led to war. Now, as I've often said in this podcast many times over, that the view that we have of Woodrow Wilson, well, a naive view that's often put about, that he looked upon this sinister interplay of European states, which periodically, you know, it could be described as that, as being something that needed to be swept away into history's dustbin and replaced by an egalitarian, fair, legalistic and most importantly pluralistic system where poor nations and rich nations alike had a democratic voice at a world forum. That's not quite what Wilson had in mind. Wilson did object to secret treaties. Wilson did frown upon European colonies, but he disliked colonialism, because it was a means by which the British and the French and other powers could put tariff barriers around large parts of the world and impede American trade. So the new world that Wilson was wanting to create was really going to be a level playing field, but it wasn't going to be a level playing field for everybody else. It was going to suit rising American economic, military and political power, and it was going to be designed with America in mind. So on January the 25th at the Paris Peace Conference, it was formally proved that a commission under the League of Nations would be established. The American delegation even proposed making an animated film about this. They proposed showing the old system of European alliances and secret treaties and empires being swept away, and a new world being built upon the ashes of the old, a new new order. And they thought that this would hopefully be wildly commercially successful. Now, the problem for us in studying the League of Nations is that we live on the other side of appeasement. We live on the other side of the failure of the League of Nations. We know what happened. We live on the other side of Hitler and the Holocaust, and we have lived through the various successes and failings of the United Nations. We are on the other side of a historical watershed, really, which is the Second World War. So we have a view now of the League of Nations, one of failure and one of naivety. But people in 1919 didn't have that perspective, or at least not all of them did. So we need to kind of rid ourselves of our preconceptions about the League of Nations if you want to actually go back and try to understand the perspectives of the planners of the League. The system of international relations had been changed forever by the realities of the First World War. War itself, as a device of state, had changed from the 18th to the 19th centuries. In the 18th century, war was a far more limited affair. Wars did not consume large chunks of the nation's manpower and resources, or the majority of the nation's manpower and resources. And wars could be brought to an end when they were more costly or far too costly for one of the participants. The wars between Britain and France throughout the 18th century are examples of this. In the 19th century, the development of unified nation states in Europe, the power of nationalism, and the advent of new technology make wars far more bloody affairs. You only need to look at the Austro-Prussian War or the Franco-Prussian War for evidence of that. And obviously the First World War, which is a war of national survival for nearly all of the participants, and a total war and a global one, means that now war is not seen as a tool of statecraft. It's seen as the most frightening and terrifying force that states between them can unleash. And if you add in the influenza epidemic that swept across Europe afterwards, the consequences of war are simply too great. The development of air power and the understanding at the end of the First World War that the next war, if it came about, would be fought from the air, and that it could not be kept in the battlefield, and it would be fought on the home front, and cities would be wiped from the maps. This meant that ending war, if possible, was a goal which should certainly be striven towards. And the level of support that is there for the League of Nations in European countries and amongst the populations of some European countries, if you look at Great Britain, there's a huge amount of support for it, tells you another interesting story, that it wasn't simply statesmen that were emotionally and passionately connected to the League of Nations. It was millions and millions of anonymous men and women who saw the League of Nations as the best avenue for avoiding a future conflict. It was not lost on large numbers of British people, French people, and other Europeans that the business of the Paris Peace Conference was largely unresolved, and that Germany and other parties in the conference had gone away with a great deal of discontent and anger, and bubbling forces of nationalism were there ready for a rematch. In David Reynolds' The Long Shadow and Richard Overy's The Morbid Age, this sense of pessimism, fear, and the sense that civilization may be moving towards its final moment hang like dark clouds over the kind of British collective consciousness, and the desperation to avoid the trenches of the First World War again is a real significant part in shaping British public life. Margaret Macmillan, in her book Peacemakers, makes the point that the growth in participatory democracy in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the mixture of democracy and nationalism as mass participatory political movements, it was assumed that these things would aid the League of Nations. She writes, the spread of democracy, the growth of nationalism, the web of railway lines and telegraphs, the busy journalists and rotary presses churning out mass circulation newspapers, all this has summed up a creature that governments did not much like, but which they dared not ignore. At Paris, it was assumed that negotiations would be conducted under public scrutiny. For idealists, this was a good thing. The people would bring a much-needed common sense to international relations. They did not want war or expensive arms races. This faith had not been shaken by the fact that many Europeans seemed enthusiastic about war in the decades before 1914 and positively passionate in 1914 itself. And there were many idealists in Europe and indeed throughout the world. The prosperity and progress of the 19th century encouraged the belief that the world was becoming more civilised. A growing middle class provided a natural constituency for a peace movement preaching the virtues of compulsory arbitration of disputes, international courts, disarmament, perhaps even pledges to abstain from violence as ways to prevent wars. The opponents of war took as models their own societies, especially those in Western Europe, where governments had become more responsive to the will of the citizens, where public police forces had replaced private guards, and where the rule of law was widely accepted. Surely it was possible to imagine a similar society of nations providing collective security for its members. So that was the kind of part of the intellectual foundation of the League of Nations, that the developments that had been seen in the Western world, particularly, you know, the advance of what you would think of as modernity in most countries where there had been industrial revolutions, the development of mass democracy, an efficient bureaucracy in the state, what you see in those countries is a decline in violence. People are, life isn't perfect, but the incidences of civil wars, banditry, and people killing each other in large numbers dramatically decreases. And therefore, surely this is now possible as we start to develop into what you think of as a global society. Sadly not, it would appear. The conference was, the League of Nations Commission, I beg your pardon, was chaired by Wilson at his insistence. And the League of Nations is the centrepiece of all his ambitions at the conference.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Prince, he thought that the quicker you can bring it into being, the more quickly any problem of arbitration or the threat of violence can be resolved, and therefore whatever is left over at the end of the Paris Peace Conference will simply go through the arbitration processes at the League of Nations, and the League of Nations will almost be like an ongoing peace conference in its own right. And Wilson thought that the possibilities of making a peace for everybody that was going to be lasting and was going to resolve all issues and be seen as fair all round was going to be virtually impossible at Paris anyway, and therefore you would need a league in order to deal with issues of German colonies and mandates, how the various constituent parts of the Ottoman Empire would now be run, and that the League would act as a trustee for people who, in the kind of the elitist and paternalist views of the big three at the conference, weren't yet, in inverted commas, ready to rule themselves. Margaret Macmillan also makes an important distinction between the American view of the benefactor Wilson coming to Europe to shine the light of democracy and reason, and the assumption that Europeans were incapable of this. She says, "The picture sometimes painted of Wilson sailing across the Atlantic, bearing the gift of the League of Nations from the New World to the Old, is compelling but, alas, false. Many Europeans had long wanted a better way of managing international relations. The war they had just survived made sense only if it produced a better world, an end to war. That is what their own governments had promised in the dark days, and that is what they had. That is what had kept them going. In 1919, as Europeans contemplated those catastrophic years, with scarcely imaginable outpouring of blood, as they realised that European society had been horribly damaged, perhaps fatally, the League struck many, and not only liberals and left-wingers, as their last chance. Harold Nicholson, who was a member of the British delegation, British Treasury official at the time, spoke for many of his generation when he said, 'We were journeying to Paris not merely to liquidate the war, but to found a new order in Europe. We were preparing not peace only, but eternal peace. There was about us the halo of some divine mission. We must be alert, stern, righteous and ascetic, for we were bent on doing great, permanent and noble things.'" Lloyd George was more than happy to support Woodrow Wilson. He agreed that with Wilson that the first order of business should be the League of Nations. And this wasn't simply the fact that Lloyd George was hoping to keep the Americans happy in order to extract imperial concessions from the conference, but he did have part of the liberal tradition of opposition to the war and opposition to war and militarism in general still within him. But he also knew how deeply the war had affected the British national psyche and how traumatised the British had been by the war. And any move towards preventing future conflict in Lloyd George's eyes would be electorally popular. And therefore Lloyd George also knew that to come back from the Paris Peace Conference empty-handed without a League of Nations, without any insurance to the British people that they weren't going to be dragged into another European war, and without any institution that could arbitrate between rival powers and calm tensions, would have been political suicide for him. The mood is different in France. There was pessimism about the possibility of international cooperation to prevent war. And as far as Clemenceau is concerned, dealing with Germany is the big issue. Dealing with reparations and also with a permanent security arrangement for France, which Clemenceau later sees as an Atlantic League between America, Britain and France. That's the future for France as Clemenceau sees it. Clemenceau isn't necessarily hostile to the League of Nations, but ambivalent. He sees it as unworkable and unrealistic, and sees it also as largely toothless. He thinks that international law, and particularly the territorial integrity of France, cannot be enforced with goodwill, and it needs a military force behind it, which all proponents of the League are not presenting, or would be wildly unrealistic anyway. He was quoted as saying, "I like the League, but I do not believe in it." And this reflects the different historical conditions that have affected France. France has been invaded in 1870 and in 1914, and from 1914 to 1918, long struggles have been waged upon French soil. Much of the fighting in the First World War is done on the Western Front in France, and France is the country that has borne most of the brunt of Europe's fighting. So a focus on defending against Germany is far more significant, and at most in the minds of Clemenceau and other French diplomats and leaders, than it is for other states, particularly Britain and America. Also, Clemenceau had eyes on territories in the old Ottoman Empire, particularly Syria and Palestine, and thought that France should be rewarded with colonial territories after the war for the troubles she had been put to during it. And it seemed unlikely to him to begin with that the League of Nations would be a device by which the imperial power of France could be extended. In point of fact, the mandate system allows Britain and France to gorge themselves on new colonies. So it works out quite well for imperialists at the end of the day. When Clemenceau does engage with the League of Nations discussions, he really believes that unless the League of Nations has teeth, it's pointless, and that the League of Nations should have the power to stop aggressors militarily. And if this is feasible, then this does present a realistic option for the defence of France, which is one of Clemenceau's chief goals. The British and the Americans think that institutions and international law and tribunals and arbitration would be the most likely approach to maintain a lasting international peace. Their concern is the cost of an international peacekeeping or an international military force, and also the threat that that might present to their own ambitions if necessary. The voice of pacifism that was developing and increasingly powerful in the towards the end of the First World War demanded disarmament. This would be the way in which the League of Nations would prevent future conflict. General disarmament and a promise by members to abstain from war. And the question then emerged that if the League had the power to do these kinds of things, would it itself emerge eventually as some kind of supranational legal body or a state in its own right? Would it be like the Congress system, a Concert of Europe, a Concert of the World, where heads of state would gather largely in secret to discuss world affairs and kind of negotiate with one another. Would it be a permanent body? Would it be summoned in a crisis? And who would be allowed to join? Could dictatorships join? Could the Bolsheviks join? Would only democratic societies be able to join? Would societies considered to be backward and primitive be able to join? What would be the membership rules and procedures? Would there be a secretariat? Wilson had been very quiet during the war on specifics, knowing full well that only once the war had ended and the conditions on the ground were clear that he could make any sort of prediction as to what would be possible. The power of the League, as Wilson saw it, would come from humanity itself. If it represented the will of all peoples everywhere, then it was would be impossible to countermand or to ignore. The war had clearly shown that the ordinary peoples of the world needed some kind of organisation to protect their interests. It is interesting what Wilson was saying about the inability of governments to achieve that any longer under conditions of total war. And that what he referred to as the councils of plain men, the councils as in the thoughts and opinions and judgments of plain men, have become on all hands more simple and straightforward and more unified than the council of sophisticated men of affairs, who still retain the impression that they are playing a game of power and playing for high stakes. So what Wilson was saying there was the gradual democratisation of much of the world in the late 20th century had presented the great statesman who had led to these catastrophes with an immense challenge, and that the councils of plain men would sweep all before them and were far more significant and important. There was perhaps in what Wilson was saying some of the utopianism of the progressive era that had largely kind of died out by about 1919, in no small part as a result of the war, still present, and part of the kind of utopian thoughts of modernists before the war, during and to some extent afterwards, were there in the founding moments of the League of Nations. Unfortunately, whilst throughout the 20th century these ideas and notions of democratisation and a greater role of the public, the global public, if you will, in world affairs has been there. There has been a very uneven path towards this, and the League of Nations, as we know, one of the things that distinguishes it in popular memory is this journey from utopianism to the bitter reality of the Second World War. Anyway, we'll talk more about that in the coming weeks, and I hope this has been an interesting podcast for you. Come and check us out on the Explaining History Facebook page. Come say hi, and it'd be great to have a chat, and I'll look forward to speaking to you soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.